I know it's rather inappropriate to immediately advertise, but I am actually speaking on this topic because of this book that's just come out, The Light of Christ, An Introduction to Catholicism. And I would encourage you to buy it, to read yourself or give to someone else if you're interested in sort of the basic presentation of Catholic faith accessible to a non-specialist. It presupposes a person interested in questions of science and religion, historical Jesus studies, Catholic moral teaching, but it doesn't presuppose any expertise. And so that's part of the kind of reason I'm interested in this question of the rationality of the mystery or the reasonability of the Christian religion and of Catholicism in particular in the 21st century. So let me just say a few words about what this lecture is not. So this is not a polemical lecture of, I'm aware of where I am, I'm at Baylor, it's a Baptist university. This is not a polemical Protestant versus Catholic kind of portrait. I'm interested in Protestant-Catholic dialogue and dispute, disputation. I studied a lot of Calvin and Karl Barth, and I'm myself, in all honesty, a convert from Protestantism and Catholicism. So, I mean, I think seriously about Protestant objections to Catholicism, and I'm open to that in the Q&A. If you want to ask me about the Virgin Mary and all those kinds of questions that one typically gets, I happily receive them. But it's not about that. It's also actually not about an ecumenical engagement of what we have in common as Protestants and Catholics, nor is it a apologetic defense of Catholicism and why people should be Christian, although there's a little of that. It's actually just an exercise in theology. I'm trying to think about the difficulties and challenges, but also opportunities and possibilities for believing in Catholic Christianity in the 21st century, and why I think the rationality of the mystery of Christ and the rationality of the mystery of the Church are convincing or have an integrity to them intellectually for us as modern 21st century people. So it's an exercise in thinking theologically about the mystery of Christ and the Church. And what I want to do is focus on, you might call it, four zones of rationality. I'm going to try to go, Dominicans have a tendency to speak a little longer than they ought. I'm going to try to do this briskly and leave time for Q&A. I want to look at four sort of poles of intelligibility of Christianity in the 21st century along the lines I've been saying. And by the way, there's lots of block quotes on the handout. Don't worry, I'm not going to read them. If you find the talk really miserable and boring, you can read them. What they are, they're sort of signposts of major documents of the Catholic Church or the Catholic tradition that speak to these questions. And some of them are contemporary documents of the Catholic Magisterium. If you Google them, you'll find them very quickly, and you can sort of read them painlessly on your own. So it seems to me that one of the key challenges to any coherent theory of Christian belief in the 21st century stems from the great tide of, let's call it, historicist, and by that very fact, relativistic ways of thinking about Christianity in the 20th century. So if we go back to a thinker that you may or may not have studied, like Ernest Troeltsch, in the early 20th century, great German liberal Protestant figure, Troeltsch's great argument was that Christianity must, in the modern world, be subject to the same processes of study and historical analysis as all other world religious traditions, and should in no way be thought to be absolute among the other religions, but only as one other religious tradition among the many. It's sort of, as it were, the face of God as seen from the European continent, even though the face of God might be seen somewhere, some ways very differently in the Indian subcontinent, in the Hindu traditions. Right, so on the one hand, Troeltsch wants to emphasize in a kind of way that anticipates modern religious studies departments, the idea of studying the religious traditions historically critically, including the Bible, of course, as a human artifact, Old and New Testament as products of ancient Jewish writers, authors, but also embedding religious systems sociologically in a larger framework, looking at religion as a historical human artifact, human religious traditions. And that is a way of approaching Christianity which evaporates or reduces its originality or makes its claims to originality difficult. Now, I think Catholicism has had a kind of, in the 20th century, twofold response to Troeltsch. On the one hand, of course, that's not compatible with classical Catholic Christianity because of the belief in the uniqueness of the Incarnation, that God has, in a way that is in some ways intellectually scandalous to many, so-called scandal of particularity. The theologians talk about it that way, the scandal of particularity. God has become human in time and lived a human historical existence among us. So Catholic belief in the incarnation mitigates against the relativism of Trelsch. But the Catholic Church has also always insisted on the human character of human religion. Sometimes it's said that Catholicism is a way of thinking that's a both-and way of thinking. There's both the uniqueness of the Christian religion and there's the common human religiosity of Christianity among the world religions. Now, the seeds of this, I think, actually, for thinking about this well, it's not surprising, I'll appeal to a Dominican, Thomas Aquinas, 13th century. Thomas Aquinas asks in the second part of the second part of the Summa Theologiae whether religion is a natural virtue. It's an interesting question because many medieval theologians, like St. Bonaventure, the great Franciscan, think that religion is fundamentally a theological virtue. That's to say, it stems from the grace of the Holy Spirit that infuses charity into our hearts. So it's because the human soul has received a conversion through grace to Christ and lives in charity that the human being is religious, specifically speaking. You might say what specifies religion as an activity is charity as a gift of the Holy Spirit. That's Bonaventure. Aquinas says no. Religion is something natural to the human being and is a part of the virtue of justice. It's the way the human creature resolves its finitude in the face of its creator and turns to the creator to acknowledge dependency and gratitude, ingratitude. Now, Aquinas goes on in a nuanced way to say, you might ask, why are not all human beings religious, or why are not all human beings religious in the same way across time and place? And there Aquinas talks about lots of factors of ignorance and weakness that assail our human condition, such that we are often not very religious, not successfully religious, or religious in ways that are confused. Rather, he says, either by what we worship or the way in which we worship. And he calls that in Latin superstitio, bad religion. It's an updated version of the term. Superstition is bad religion. Worshiping the wrong thing, worshiping the wrong way. So what you can see him saying is that the human heart is naturally tendentially religious. We seek, actually Aquinas thinks the fundamental principles in the mind. When the human mind seeks to understand reality in its ultimate horizon and to explain the world, it looks off onto religious explanations. God as the ultimate cause of things. And that then the human heart aspires to the highest good, it aspires to the most universal good that can really fully satisfy the human heart, and so it aspires naturally to a religious horizon. Okay, so the mind and heart have a religious amplitude for Aquinas, but they often, it's confused. It's like static on the radio, getting in the way of clear signals from the divine. And that's why Aquinas thinks the incarnation is so important. When he asks the question later on in the Summa, why did God become human? Why did God become human? It's a deeply Christian theological question. It presupposes the reality of the incarnation. Why would God bother to become human? One of the reasons he gives is to speak to human animals who are spiritual but also sensate in terms that we can receive, to show us who God is in our own manifest human condition. So the incarnation is a kind of rectification and elevation of our common religious condition. We are able to resolve that amplitude of human knowing and loving, that aspiration to religious life that's in us as a principle of nature, principle of justice. We're able to resolve it in light of Christ. So it's a both and answer, because the revelation of the incarnation then allows you to see how human aspirations of religions are not ultimately arbitrary or fatalistic or errant, but actually our search for God has a kind of resolution. Okay, so I mean, I think to finish this first point in a summary way, and it's to say a sort of second thought, it seems to me that the Catholic, traditional Catholic appeal to the mystery of the incarnation as a sort of answer of God to the human quest for God, that God became human so that we might really fully encounter God, also has a very deep rationality to it for the human search for explanation in general. Why? Well, because
As Ratzinger points out in his book, Introduction to Christianity, and a number of other lectures, it presupposes that if the incarnation is true, then the human search for explanation is not in vain. God has, in a certain way, answered us by coming into our history to reveal to us who God is, and therefore has made the ultimate explanation principle of reality available to us.
It gives you a confidence in reason. You actually see this right at the beginning of the letter of John's Gospel, where it says, in the beginning was logos, rationality,
and the word became flesh, logos. The reason of God became flesh. But allied with love, if there's one sort of extremely clear manifest point of Christian rationality, it's that God became human to manifest the love of God through the atonement and the resurrection. And so what you get is this very powerful claim about an absolute unveiling in the incarnation of rationality, God's divine purposes, and divine love in a way that is not mythological. Human religions are often centered around this, ways that we human beings try to articulate our encounter with the divine, stories of gods, stories of encounter with the gods, and claims about, you might say, human beings generate revelation, right? Not all claims to revelation are true. There's a lot that are humanly generated. But it shows the aspiration of the human spirit to come into contact with the divine. Everything from the Bhagavad Gita to the Book of Mormon is a kind of expression of religious desire for immediate contact with God through revelation. And what the Catholic claim is that that has been answered in an absolute disclosure of God in history that is non-mythological, where rationality and love have become utterly manifest and given us a deep sense of the meaning of things. And my only claim here, I mean, there's all lots of other things one can talk about. The historical Jesus problem, the problem of evil, lots of other things. But my claim here really is just very simple, is that this basic claim of Christocentricity of the incarnation in Catholicism and traditional Catholic Christianity is as powerful in the 21st century as it's ever been. Where you have a human race that is increasingly as globally united as we've ever been. We can know about what's happening on the side of the world in 5 seconds through the internet, but we're as metaphysically and religiously disoriented as we've ever been. And we're a humanity very much in search for a common vocabulary of meaning, a common sense of meaning, and the incarnation is the answer God has given, which will continue, I think, in the 21st century to be a lodestar, a point of orientation for reason and for ethics. John Henry Newman famously said, somewhat polemically, to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. He says that in the Apologia about why studying early church history made him Catholic. But I think in the 21st century, to be deep in history will cause us to cease to be religious relativists. Because I think as we study the traditional religions more deeply, we'll see actually they're very different and their claims are incompatible with each other. And it's the personalism of Christ which is stands out, that God is a person, and God has made himself present in the person of Christ, and God has disclosed to us that persons are ultimate, that our personhood matters. So I want to turn on that to the question of the cosmos. I think if you look at contemporary surveys of, what are they called, nuns, young people who have no religious affiliation, rising massively in America, already massively risen in Europe, you will see that one of the principal things that people appeal to as one of the reasons they're genuinely perplexed as to why anyone would be religious is the rise of the modern science, scientific revolution. Okay, the effects of scientific revolution and the fact that we have a different story now than the religions tell that starts with the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago, something like that, and then after the universe goes through a long period of crystallization of a certain kind, you have about 4 billion years ago, the conditions in which life could emerge in this planet, primarily in single-celled bacteria, and that after a couple billion years of that, you get more complex forms that emerge and evolve, and eventually this drive through whatever is happening in the evolutionary process to more complex forms of sentient animals eventually emerging with, you know, something like our ancestors, Homo sapiens, that would be highly evolved tool-using animals, perhaps not rational animals, in the strict sense, maybe as old as 500,000 years ago, but then you get signs of rational human culture, complex tools, language, symbolic art, clothing, maybe 50,000 years ago, and so maybe the emergence of human civilization then. This story is held up as being one that's incompatible with Genesis, the original creation of man and woman in the image of God, the fall from grace, the loss of original innocence, and the destiny of life after death of the human being beyond this world. Now, as you can imagine, some of you would know this and some of you might not, the Catholic Church has invested a great deal of intellectual energy in the 20th century and in the 21st century in thinking about this conundrum, in my opinion, to good effect. In fact, I would say that if rightly conducted, this dialogue between science and religion can occur with total serenity, and that with the right philosophy, it's possible. I didn't say right science, and I didn't say right theology, it's the right philosophy. It's possible to hold serenely to the modern scientific worldview and to everything in classical Christianity, including the historicity of hominization, the creation of man and woman in the image of God, and the historical fall and its consequences. But the key to doing this, I think, is to go back to another idea from Aquinas of what's called the doctrine of primary and secondary causality. So when Aquinas talks about God causing the world to be, he calls this God's primary causality. God is the principal cause of all things. It's very important to understand that for St. Thomas, and also in general for Catholic thinking, the causation of creation is not a historical past event, as if God created the world and then left it to its own. It's God causing everything that exists to exist now and sustaining in being actually. Okay, so it's actual causation of all that exists. So like right now, everybody in this room, everything on this campus, everything in Texas, everything in America, everything in the cosmos. Notice I did put the cosmos after Texas. Everything depends upon the creative agency of God sustaining in being now. Right, so we're all actually dependent upon God's primary cause. Then Aquinas says, it gives greater dignity to God to not only create causes that are themselves passively received recipients, but also themselves causal agents. And so everybody in this room is a causal agent. You know, there's like how many thousands of things do we intentionally do during the day, in one day. But there's also the causal agency of the oxygen in the room. It's active. There's the cause, it causes oxygenation. It's the causal activity of the elements, or the causal activity of animals and plants. Okay. The point is that for Aquinas, everything that comes from a secondary cause comes entirely from the secondary cause and entirely from the primary cause simultaneously. Right? So everything I'm doing comes entirely from me as an agent and entirely from God causing me to exist as an agent simultaneously, without violence. Now, that's a very simple, it's a very deep philosophical principle. You just like thinking about it. It has a certain simplicity and elegance to it. Once you start to get your mind around it, there's no more deep opposition between modern science and metaphysics of creation. Because God can cause at every moment the whole universe to exist as a universe in which there are causal agents that themselves have effects in the world around them that effectuate change of all kinds. This has never really been a traditional problem in Christianity with regards to human freedom. Christians believe that their human freedom is given them by God, and mysteriously, that they're truly free agents. I know people get very perplexed about it. It is a subject of great debate, but everyone sort of affirms the fundamentals, and intuitively it makes sense. God is giving me my human freedom, and I'm a truly free agent. But analogously, the universe is a universe of agency, and that means there can be from the point of view of the secondary causes, chance encounters. We know this. You go to the grocery store to buy, it's Baylor, so you didn't go to the grocery store to buy beer. You went to the grocery store to buy pretzels. And then you see somebody else going to the grocery store to buy God knows what. And the thing is that you weren't planning to meet them there. You met them there by chance. It's real. But the chance is ontologically or metaphysically a parasite. It depends upon a host, and the host is a causal agent. So when you're going to the grocery store, it's a border act, and the other guy's going to the grocery store, it's a border act, the fact that you meet by chance is a product of two ordered lines of causality that intersect. And that's all you have, right, in cosmic evolution, cosmic development prior to life forms. And then if evolutionary theory
is verifiably reasonable to believe in, which I myself think it is, then you have something like chance encounters that are part and parcel of the way that random selection, so-called random selection, happens.
But Mr. Dawkins and his friends are in error to say that because there are random events that occur, that there isn't more fundamentally order or government.
Because a primary cause can govern all the things from above.
And then there's the soul. And here I think philosophy has an important role to play to argue that there is something specifically different when you get to the drama of the human condition. And that we can have a full kind of realism about neuroscience and human animality. We can study human being biologically, neurologically, but there is a deep and irreducible dimension of human being that is not reducible to matter or material causation alone, which is located in especially our human agency of knowing rationally, conceptually, and universally, and willing freely. So as rational agents and as free agents, as people of knowledge and love, we are not like the other animals. We are in many ways like them. We are sub animals. But there's something distinct about us by virtue which we're in the image of God. And that had a beginning. That had a beginning. And the Catholic Church teaches that that had a beginning in grace. And the reason that's very advantageous is because the moral drama of being a human being is not going anywhere. The dangers of reductive biological naturalism is that you can really only understand other human beings as mere animals, as mere matter.
In the 20th century, that had devastating ethical consequences for the human race through Marxist and Nazi ideology in two different ways. And in the 21st century, that's going to have devastating consequences for the human race ethically through genetic manipulation of human beings and women, which is becoming a whole vista that's going to open up. And when man makes himself the master of the other man's characteristics and starts genetically engineering the human race one off against the other, you enter into a tunnel of darkness. But the great answer to this kind of biological reductionism is to see that the human being has a spark of the divine of intellect and will.
And I think that this is going to continue to be important ethically, because you need actual foundational reasons for why human dignity has to be maintained. It's not enough to say we've always done it that way, because we never do it the same way forever. Actually, things do change in the culture radically, as we've seen recently with regards to marriage. And so if you don't have deep down convictions about what human dignity consists in, is grounded in, of a philosophical sort, you can't really survive the waves of cultural transformation with a coherent philosophy. But that coherent philosophy does exist, and we have access to it. The third thing I want to talk about is happiness. And I'm transitioning down to ethics. If you had X-ray machine that you could read, you could like see people's minds and hearts and see what they're thinking, and you were to talk, you could get a sample group, you start talking about Christianity, and especially I think you're talking about Catholicism, and you can like look at them with X-ray machines, you start thinking, they're starting to think about sexual morality, and they're starting to think about prohibitions. They're starting to think about the list of things one ought never to do, and what one is allowed to do with regards to, you know, traditional Christian morality. And they may have confused about that, you know, just of do's and don'ts. But the thing is that's in their minds. That's fine, it's normal because of the effects of the sexual revolution on our culture and the way that traditional Christianity stands in some contrast with sexual revolution. But the deeper kind of issue that touches upon is whether morality in Christianity is fundamentally a morality of obligation and of permissions and of obligations and of prohibitions, which is what the modern contemporary imagination typically thinks it is, or if it's fundamentally a morality of happiness. And the answer to the question classically is clear and unambiguous. Augustine and Aquinas and all the great scholastic doctors say the same thing. The fundamental principle of human morality in Catholicism is happiness. It's all about seeking beatitude or happiness. That is the aim of the Christian life. It's not about moral prohibitions or obligations. Those exist. It's true. It's always wrong to murder the innocent. But deep down, the goal of refraining from murdering the
this, and seeking the contrary, which is to be affable to every human being based on their innate dignity,
friendly and just
to each human being, is in order to grow the virtue of justice and to acquire justice, not just so you can like flex your moral muscles in the mirror and say I'm just, but in order to actually acquire the happiness of the just soul. There's a stability and a happiness, a serenity, and a joy that come from living to learn living to live in justice, in temperance, in fortitude, and in prudence, which are the four classical virtues. I have a friend who's a Dominican who describes that he's from San Francisco Bay Area, and as you maybe know, there are different traditions of jazz in America, New Orleans is of course famous, Chicago's famous, New York's famous, and San Francisco's famous. So he's from San Francisco, he talks about the moral theologian, he talks about jazz analogies often. And he notes this, that to become a very good jazz musician, you must master fundamental basics. You have to learn how to like play all kinds of standard scales and master the fluid movement from scale in one key to scale in another key, etc., as you're moving along. And that is like kind of a pedagogy that requires a lot of sense. You know, we don't think of jazz as like a setup thing. But actually, they cared for hours to learn to do that, and they must master themselves. They must master the art of playing, you know, the jazz piano. But because they have that gift, they can then play with each other in jazz ensembles, and they can innovate precisely because they're all masters. Because they know how to transition so fluidly and have really honed their souls as jazz musicians, they can suddenly pivot in very difficult turns within music of spontaneity and improvisation, where one is taking the lead to the others, and they can all move together and hear each other. And so there's a kind of expertise that comes from the training of the soul. And as he knows, that's what the virtues do for you with regard to the happiness. That if you have become a person who has worked at becoming a just person of affability, fairness, kindness, thoughtfulness, measured speech and action, of prudence, who is thoughtful about how to make things work for yourself and others, with your intellectual practical mind, of temperance, who has a certain control over your senses, and of sensate joys and sorrows, and of fortitude, so you overcome moral laziness or animosity and undisciplined anger. If you work on all that, then you can actually begin to fluidly move in the stream of charity. I'm comparing jazz and charity here. Charity is like this movement of the freedom of divine love in the human soul that allows you to love in Christ all human beings. And the virtues are these sort of pathways that allow us to structure our collaboration with, our cooperation with the grace of charity, and to always live in love intelligently. Now that is the moral tradition
of the Catholic moral life, and it's very promising in our contemporary setting. Because we are a culture exhausted with the ethics of obligation, of prohibitions, of obligations. We have now new moralism. We have the old moralism of Christian, Victorian, whatever. Now we have the new moralism of political correctness, which a lot of people find exhausting. And it's a new kind of puritanism. It seems to be in crisis. It seems to be in conflict, a source of conflict. It's not a source of unity. And it's not enough to simply say, well, you know, let's just all be libertarian and respect each other's freedom. Because the problem is, freedom is weighty. It has a certain gravity to it. You have to live out the burden and responsibility of freedom. And it's taxing because it's animated by desire. You have to resolve your desires well, or you end up living a life that's foolish and unhappy. So it's not enough to have just procedural liberalism that's libertarian. And it's not enough to have just the moralism of political correctness or the old shadows of remnants of Victorian Puritanism. What we really need is the ethics of happiness that the classical Christian tradition provides. And I want to just finish by talking about this fourth point, the sacramental society. Now, this is not really a polemical point, nor is it about Protestantism, nor is it really it's not a false compliment. I mean, speaking from within the Catholic tradition, there's something extremely powerful about the kind of individualism modern European Protestantism bequeathed the world. Because an individual who really stands for something and is a vibrant personality is a very powerful human being, especially if they're a truth agent. Right? So there's something very forceful to individualism, and there's something forceful to the European individualism that came out of the Reformation, and then in a different way developed very powerfully in the Enlightenment. That being said, individualism, there's no question, we live in an individualistic American and European culture that is deeply marked by this aspiration to autonomy, individual autonomy. But we're also very threatened by it, and we're threatened by it in part because of its alliance now with capitalist market systems and modern technology, so that our individualism has made us available to be either purchasers or often workers in the market who, allied with technology, are able to move all over the world, be unrooted from where our families came from, be reincorporated into new societies that are created really for the sake of the product of capital. I'm in favor of market economy and have deep criticisms of the whole communist system, but we also need to not be blind about the ways that our autonomy is actually in many ways an autonomy for a kind of spiritual enslavement, often to a system of commerce that we make ourselves available for. The problem is not, I don't think, per se the market, but the point is there has been, I also think, you know, to be direct about it, I think another big reason that individualism has become very dangerous to us is because of contraception. Because the effect of contraception is that we now have the possibility of human sexuality without the attachments of marriage, and therefore there's a lot less marriage. Mark Regner's new book on this is extremely prescient and insightful of how the sexual revolution and the effects of contraception allowed us to create a commodified kind of market of individualized sexual relations, and therefore fragmenting the family, fragmenting our relationship with children, and created actually a society of lonely people. I live in a modern urban, secular city on the East Coast, and there are a lot of young people and even a lot of middle-aged people and older people who suffer from extreme sense of being unrooted and drifting and not being connected, and often can't get married. You know, they can't find people who want to get married because of the problems of an over kind of extended autonomy. Okay, why am I talking about this? Because in the face of all this, I think that Henry de Lubac's book on Catholicism in the mid-20th century, which is a very important book, if you haven't ever read it, it doesn't matter even if you're interested in Catholicism, just for the true ideas, you should read this book by de Lubac called Catholicism on the Social Destiny of the Human Race. I think that book's more actually applicable to our own age than when he wrote it, because the basic argument there is he's arguing theologically man is never saved alone. We're only ever saved in society. And that the sociality of our animality is part of the way that we follow Christ in the visible church. But I think this has taken on a new acuity in our own era because we live in such a world of really often existentially deracinated individual human beings who suffer from the burdens of their own autonomy in a society where autonomy is not leading to the creation of social structures of support and love and communion. And here I think the Catholic community, because of the insistence on the sacramental society, the visible church, has an important initiative to take to offer isolated, often solitary, modern human beings a sense of communion, of participation in something greater than themselves, of life in a society of visible fellowship that is not merely natural, but also supernatural, because it's rooted in the communion of the Eucharist, the communion of the sacraments, grace of Christ present, really present, substantially present even, in his body and blood, and in the charity of life in Christ that flows from the sacrament of the Eucharist. Aquinas, when he asks this question I've given you in the text, here in the third part of the Summa Theologiae, when he asks, are the sacraments necessary for salvation? He's using the word necessary in lots of different senses, sort of like, why do we really need sacraments? Is it really necessary? Are these sacraments really necessary? One of the reasons he says they really are necessary is because we're animals. And we live out the spiritual impulse to seek the truth about God and the truth and to love God. We live all that out in our bodies.
We live it out in our physical selves, our senses.
And so this is an important way to,
I'm going to finish with these thoughts here. Obviously, one way this is totally counterintuitive to our contemporaries. To finish what we started, just like with the religious relativist, who's to say this religion is really true, it's all relative, maybe there's no one religious tradition that's absolute. So then people self-designate as I'm spiritual but not religious. And it's actually very common for people to say, I don't exclude the spiritual life, but I do exclude the discipline of religious commitment, dogmas, and rituals.
But actually, I think it's important to hear to show that the spiritual animal, to be spiritual, needs to also be physically spiritual.
Be spiritual in your body, in what you do, how you live, there's a coherence of like trying to find God in every aspect of your life. And that's hard to do alone. It's a lot easier to do with others. And it's not easy for just a group to get together and make stuff up. You really need something to be given, the structure, the physical impulses of human religiosity, and that what has been given by Christ are the sacraments as causes of grace. We call them instruments of grace because they are signs and instruments through which God gives grace to the world. And that, I think, answers the felt need of the human animal to be spiritual with others in society.
So I don't know exactly how to go about talking to everybody under the sun about how to be spiritual and religious, rather than spiritual but not religious, or to be religious because you're spiritual. Because you're spiritual, you should be religious. But I believe in the 21st century, the church has an opportunity to think about the sacraments as a kind of answer to that human problem. So those are just some sketches and vignettes about thinking about the challenges and possibilities, opportunities for Catholic Christianity in the 21st century. And there are no bad questions, and the questions don't have to be precisely on the talk, but I'm now going to open the floor for questions. I think Adam has kindly said he would circulate the microphone. What am I trying to say? Well, go ahead and ask your question, and then I'll.
This is on Catholic social teaching.
Yeah.
As a Catholic, I don't fully agree with what the Catholic teaches, just about the destination of common goods, or the common.
The universal destination of goods. You should definitely agree with that.
The lens of that, how can the Catholic Church prescribe a specific set of governmental responsibilities upon a specific government in the mindset of capitalist tendencies?
Okay, so your objection, that's a great question, your objection to the principle of the universal destination of goods is, I think, based on a problematic reading of it, a misconception of what it is. So the first thing to say, maybe not, okay, but the first thing to say is the universal destination of goods is not the teaching that there's not a right to private property. The Church has always taught that there is a right to private property. And in the 20th century, it doesn't absolutize like a contemporary market system. By contemporary, I mean the last 300 years. I mean, Brian's not going to live long, but it hasn't always existed. And so the Church is going to say this is the one way that commerce can only ever take place. But it knows many good benefits of it, you know, in terms of generating modern technology, medicine, social welfare, work.
With regards to the general principles, then, the universal destination of goods is the claim.
I think the minimum it requires of us is to believe that I am never able to take in whatever I do, own, or possess, to abstract completely from the welfare of the other person. So the classic case is you've got the multimillionaire living in a house. One is kind of an example. I'm updating it. The multimillionaire, and you've got the person across the street starving to death. And this guy's throwing away more food per day than the other person is able to. He's throwing away more food a day that's edible, and the person needs to feed their whole family. Okay. Which is, by the way, a totally realistic example in many countries of the world. Okay. The Church argues in that case, for the sake of the common good, the state does have the right and even the obligation to, in a limited way, redistribute goods so that that person doesn't starve to death.
That's a very minimal claim. I'm going to go to the wall for that claim.
But then, in terms of the implementation of policies with regards to markets, there's a wide range of ways that principles can be applied, and they really fall under the virtue of prudence rather than the strict principles of justice.
So, for example, to take the minimum wage, right? So the church argues that traditionally it's unjust to exploit a person by giving them a wage they can't live off of.
The church also has another principle that markets should be constructed by governments and such, should be aided by governments so that the most people possible can enter into wage earning.
And that people have a responsibility to work. So it's not a welfare state. Right? So if you want the most people to work, you want to keep the minimum wage pretty low. But if you want people to have a high enough standard of living, you want to keep the minimum wage pretty high. So those are contradictory principles in a certain way. You see the Democrats arguing the minimum wage should go up. You see the Republicans saying you're going to make a lot of people less employed. They're actually both appealing to principles of Catholic social democracy.
And the applications in particular of their human prudence, and really smart economists disagree about what to do.
And so in those cases, the church leaves that to experts and politicians to implement, but they should be guided by those principles, those broader principles of justice.
Thank you, Father. So here's something I spent some time wondering and worrying about as a Catholic in the 21st century, is that we have one unique problem in the 21st century in the church, at least this part of the 21st century, is we have numerous bishops and cardinals who disagree with each other on some fundamental ethical issues. Sure, you can figure out which one I'm thinking of.
You're talking about communion for the divorced remarried, in specific.
Yeah, so that would be a particularly acute example. And so I'm wondering, in light of that, you know, what kind of resources or practices would you recommend to, you know, lay Catholics, especially those who maybe, you know, don't have anything more than college education, right, to understand and fully appreciate, you know, how to adjudicate disputes like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the first thing I would say is that the history of the Catholic Church is, you know, it's funny how you can't win.
People are accusing the Catholic Church down some time of overly, like prematurely forcing people to believe things through the imposition of dogma from on high. And then if you actually have to fight about the dogma, other people accuse you of being too open-minded and not giving them an immediate answer because you're at risk to contradict yourself. And, I mean, that's not your objection. But I'm saying that it's interesting that through time, the church has been animated by a lot of deep theological arguments. I don't like them. I mean, I don't like open and prolonged arguments among bishops. I think there are a lot of reasons this should not happen. And as a priest who works in pastoral ministry, I field that question very often from disturbed lay persons. So I see the spiritual downside. But from another point of view, theologically, I think it's inevitable that down through time, as John Henry Newman says, the wild living intellect of man will impose arguments as part of the structure of history, as it were. You know, so that there's dialectic in the church. There's dialectical arguments down through time, and they have to be resolved eventually. Now, for the bewildered layperson or the person who's seeking a kind of first orientation, there's really one resource that one should look at above all other things, and that's the 1994 Universal Guide to the Catholic Church, which weighs in on all the fundamental dogmatic and moral teachings of the Catholic Church, including the stuff we were just talking about on social doctrine, including stuff on marriage and communion, including stuff on the divinity of Christ, and, I mean, all the major controversies of the Church in its past, you have a clear presentation of the resolutions there. And as somebody who myself studies theology over time, historically, I would say there are some important cases of times where the Church has strongly bent, you know, it's like strongly said one thing here and said something very different over here, and there's been a kind of a winding pathway.
But these are rare. And these are not logically inconceivable. These are not logically incompatible teachings. It's just more dramatic cases. But on the whole, I would say it's really clear to me, what strikes me as somebody who studies it, is what Newman said, is that you see like the early church is like the embryonic form of the modern Catholic Church. You see all these teachings of the early church that continue to be held today in more developed and mature form. So I'm more impressed by the continuity and the homogeneity over time. If someone wants to orient themselves to like a first kind of, you know, consultation of the church teaches on point X, look at the Catechism of the Catholic Church, is I think very sound, very traditional, and very modern also.
First, I just want to say thank you. That was a great talk. I had two questions. The first is clarification. The second is maybe a bigger question. When you were speaking of the tension between science and Christianity,
perceived tension.
Pardon?
Perceived tension.
You made a point to say that you have a philosophy, and you made a point to say that you were not saying correct theology or creation.
Yeah, I think you also needed correct theology too.
Okay.
But I think the real resolutions come about actually the philosophical things, primarily. If you get the right, I think without the right philosophical instrument, the science and the religion can't find a way to speak to one another. Obviously, you also need a doctrinal framework that comes from Old and New Testament and the tradition of church. So it's also theological.
And then we were discussing humans as spiritual animals, the necessity of the spiritual community, the physical spiritual community. Do you believe that Protestantism is incapable of providing that?
Well, I mean, insofar as Protestants are spiritual animals and worship corporately, I think that they also live out a liturgical existence. They live liturgically their belief in Christ. And there are many miserable Catholic liturgies that are in many respects worse than some beautiful Protestant liturgies. This comes down, though, I think, ultimately to one's belief about Eucharistic theology. For me, I can't resolve this question myself unless I think about what I really believe about the Eucharist and about holy orders. And I do believe that the early church believed that Christ instituted the episcopacy and that the laying on of hands from a validly ordained bishop who is himself a successor of the bishops is the condition sine qua non for ordination to the priesthood or the episcopacy. This is the teaching of the Catholic Church. I mean, this is, you know, Catholic Catholicism 101. But that means certain sacraments cannot be validly confected without a validly ordained priest or bishop who celebrate them. That's the old teaching of the Catholic Church. It's the new teaching of the Catholic Church. It's the continual teaching of the Catholic Church. And now, you know, we, with regards to Protestant sacraments, the Catholic Church holds the validity of Protestant baptism, actually believes that often marriage among Protestants is a sacrament, even if the Protestants themselves don't have that theology of marriage. We tend to presume the validity of the sacramental marriage of Protestants. And we believe God can and does confide grace to human beings in the celebration of the Lord's Supper in a Protestant church, in which we believe what is primarily being employed is bread and wine. I mean, Catholics have pretty much a Calvinist theology of Protestant sacraments. Calvin sort of says that you eat bread and wine, but you commune in spirit with the risen Christ. And so Catholics say, well, yeah, it's true that if there are not obstacles to grace in the human heart, God can give grace to a person in and through that process. But we don't believe it's identical with or the same as the Eucharist, the change of bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ in the Mass as conducted by an ordained minister. That is absolutely, I'm just reporting, you know, I mean, it's obviously a point of huge tension ecumenically, but there's no point hiding it. It's better to actually understand it and analyze it. But the Catholic teaching is not like something that was thought up about 10 years ago. I mean, it's the perpetual teaching You see it in Irenaeus in the 2nd century, something like it. Lamont.
What do you think, or how should Catholic theological philosophical formation in university college look like? Should it resemble that of seminary? Say, should Catholic college resemble that of this study, making out of studies, or to put it more generally, should it be more systematic or more great books?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot of us who work in education, young people, like, struggle with that question. There was a great move away for those of you who are, like, don't sit around and study this stuff, or maybe, like, were born in the 90s. Before the Second Vatican Council, so in the 1950s, you went to a Jesuit school in the 1950s, you went to literary in the 1950s, and you studied Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas more, you know, typically. And then there was a move towards great books programs in the 70s and 80s as a way of having something that was more conversant with the secular academy and the, like, idea of broadening. Now, that Western canon great books thing is in sort of real trouble because of the multicultural stuff, right? So, in other words, who's to say what the canon really is? If the canon is being determined by, you know, what people in the West read, you know, that's pretty fluid. So, this is a crisis in Catholic education, and then the deeper question is, in the face of the massive secularization that's happening, which is such a fact, what do people really need to be reading and studying?
I'm a both-and person, but I think we need, I mean, it's countercultural today to say it, I don't know really where it's done, maybe a little bit at Thomas Aquinas College, but I think we need to move back to a fundamental formation in Aristotle. Actually, I'd say even more Aristotle and Aquinas. I think that's true actually in secular schools. I think I was talking to a prestigious secular philosopher at the University of Virginia recently, and just saying, you know, we were talking about the fact that there's no common vocabulary to talk about meaning questions or philosophy questions across the disciplines for undergraduates. They're not going to get it from taking engineering, but increasingly they're going to get it from an analytic philosophy class. But you know, you need a kind of common lingua franca of philosophy, and I do believe the scholastic enterprise of, like, Aristotle's metaphysics, philosophy of nature, and ethics, even though a lot of people find it tedious and dull, if you get away, if you get that, make that, like, a streamlined version that makes it interesting, I think it gives foundations. And I think Aquinas helps a lot, because Aquinas is such a clear communicator of what's going on in Aristotle. But there's a danger of narrowness. And that was what people reacted against. And I do think there needs to be some breadth, including reading in modern theology, reading in great literature. You know, so I would say I think we've gone too far one direction. We need to go back, but not over and against the program of great books.
Any other questions?
Should take one more in the back, and we'll. Yeah. Well, it's great to be in Texas. This is great.
My question is, given the current chaos, conflict surrounding traditional Christian sexual ethics.
Yeah.
One, I was wondering if you had any thoughts on the national statement. If you're familiar with that, any thoughts on that? It seems like evangelicals are trying to come together and make a clear statement in a way that fights back against some of the trends that we're seeing. And then sort of relatedly, I wanted to ask you, given those trends, how important is humanae vitae today? Is it more important than it was back in the 60s? And then I guess the third question is there anything to the rumors that the church may be looking to soften humanae vitae or make it subject to conscience or something like that?
Well, for the last part, I would say I haven't heard anything that's definitive in that respect. But I think that we should be cautious about allowing the media or even people in the Roman Curia saying or doing things to determine what the official teaching is. I mean, there's a certain sense in which the church cannot, absolutely cannot change her teaching on that matter. And so if there's some kind of
principles looking at the subjective disposition of a person and this kind of thing. And we kind of deal with that very carefully. But I would say, in general, we should be skeptical about attempts to make it seem that the church has changed her teaching.
We are in a position now where there are people in the Roman Curia who occasionally seem to cast doubt on those acquisitions of church teaching. I would say be patient and don't believe every wind of rumor or about changes of doctrine. I think the church is going to outlive, her teaching will outlive those naysayers. Now, I'm not trying to dodge your question about the Nashville Statement, but I just want to say it's appropriate for me to say. I write about all that stuff here in a way, on my terms, about, like, you know, the church's teachings on chastity, all the sexual teachings, you know, partly because they're so contested. Homosexuality and contraception. Okay.
I don't think the Nashville Statement, as far as I can tell, is quite close to the traditional teaching of the Catholic Church. And so that's fine. But it's written up as a kind of doctrinal creed. And that's okay. But my point, again, about philosophy is that in the end of the day, authority only gets you so far. Even if it follows instincts of faith, follow that authority. You also need to be able to argue philosophically for why you think there are two sexes. And that really is a philosophical argument. That's not just biological science. And it's not only theology. There's all kind of metaphysics that you can person talk about the radical distinctiveness of male and female and the complementarity of male and female and the identity of man and woman as both equally and identically human. Because, of course, they're not. People talk about gender essentialism. That's a misnomer. Men and women are essentially the same thing. They're rational animals. They're, like, specifically and essentially the same thing. Just because of metaphysical truth. They're not essentially different. That's crazy. They're essentially identical. They're characteristically different because of properties, what Aristotle called accidents, which are ingrained in them at a very deep level, ineradicable, and make them complementary to each other. And I think we need to work on talking about that. With regards to human sexuality, I would say there's one of my confreres, the bishop in the Congregation of Common Faith, Archbishop Noy, talks about the nightmare menu, the menu divides down the middle. And it's once you introduce the most contrasting normative feature of humans understanding sexuality, then there's a division between the unitive and the procreative. And now all these menu choices are possible on either side of sexual acts or procreation acts that are no longer really uniting the two. So now you have all the different ways people can procure sexual pleasure, which are not related to procreation. You have all the ways people can appropriate human beings in a test tube and genetic engineering are no longer related to procreation to the sexual act. And I don't believe that's going to get any. I think that's just going to continue. We're going to see polyamorous relationships. We're going to see less structured forms of living arrangements. We're also seeing new ways of reproducing human beings. There's no reason to think the scientific revolution is going to slow down all that. So the only what was required is the same anthropology. But, you know, again, it's one thing to talk about what should be prohibited and what should be abolished, but it's nothing to talk about what will actually render human beings fulfilled and happy. And people find great happiness. I testify to you as a priest. People find great happiness in being married, committed marriage, having children, being open to life, and they enjoy it. They love it. And I watch their happiness quotient go way up. And I'm not married, so I appreciate it. I've lived a different kind of sacrificial life following Christ's call. But the good of marriage is very important, and I think the fact that that's gotten so eclipsed is tragic. Because actually nature makes us happy, and that could be a point in which you can re-engage. Humane vitae will be only more important and will only be vindicated more and more as time goes on. I'm going to liberate you, but I think there is a reception afterwards.
There is in the back, so please join us and please join me in saying how.